Well, good afternoon, friends. It's surely a pleasure and a privilege to be with you here once again this afternoon. And I think we're going to have an interesting time together. We are going to open one of the most amazing predictions or prophecies found anywhere in the Bible, and we are going to investigate it at length together. Now, this prediction that we are going to study today was discovered among the ancient scrolls found along the shores of the Dead Sea. We call them today the Dead Sea Scrolls. When the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, the prediction that we are going to study today was discovered with them in the book of Daniel. And so we are going to look at this ancient prediction that was made 2,500 years ago, contained in just short 150 words. Yet it outlines the history of the world from 600 BC right down to the times in which you and I live. And it has relevance to what we see happening in the world today. Ancient prediction, relevant to our day. Our program, pardon me, is entitled, Who Will Control the World? You've probably never heard of Charles Havlet, and understandably so. Charles' family moved from their ancestral homeland in Czechoslovakia across the Atlantic to the United States of America, and they settled in Dorchester, Nebraska. There were three boys in the family, Charles, Rudy, and Adolf. They were involved in farm work, truck driving, in their farming community. And then when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, the three boys enlisted in the military. Charles and Rudy joined the 803rd Tank Repellent Corps. And they were sent across the Atlantic to England, where they assembled their machinery, their vehicles, their equipment. They then landed on Omaha Beach and quickly traveled through North France, up into Belgium, into Holland, and then finally they crossed the Rhine River into Germany itself. They were on the road to victory. For the Nazis, the writing was on the wall. Victory was in sight for the Allies. And so this was an exciting time to be involved in these military activities. After getting into Germany, they spent some time in the Ruhr Valley, and then they crossed into Austria, and after some time there, they crossed the next border into Czechoslovakia. And so Charles Havlet was back in his ancestral homeland again. On the 7th of May, 1945, at 8:40 a.m., Charles was part of a reconnaissance group, a convoy of jeeps and military vehicles that were traveling on a dirt road about 12 kilometers into Czechoslovakia. At 8:40 exactly, their convoy came under attack from the 11th Battalion of the Panzer Brigade, a German group, who were lying beside the road. They opened with heavy machine gun fire and small arms fire and really blasted this convoy. Now, Charles was in the second vehicle in an open jeep, and their vehicle took the worst hit. He managed to get his rifle up, and he returned fire, and then he dropped down behind the hood of the jeep. After waiting a while, he popped his head up again to fire off another volley, and was shot through the head by a German sniper. His death was a real tragedy because he really should not have died. The Germans who shot him should not have been fighting because 10 minutes earlier at 8:30 a.m. on the 7th of May 1945, a ceasefire had been declared. And this ceasefire had been in place for those 10 minutes, but unfortunately, the Germans lying in ambush hadn't received the message. And so Charles Havlat died unnecessarily. Peace had already been declared. Charles, for him, as he was driving down that dirt road in Czechoslovakia, his family's homeland, the war was over. He was doing a mopping up job, reconnaissance. He was looking forward to going home, a hero who had been involved in the military campaign to free Europe. He was looking forward to returning to his family, eating mum's cooking again. His dream ended on a lonely, dusty road in Czechoslovakia with a bullet in his head. Charles Havlat was the last Allied soldier to die in World War II. Unjust, unfair, and unnecessary. He was buried in the St. Avold World War II cemetery in northern France near the provincial capital of Metz. What a waste of a life. A reminder of the futility of war in general, and specifically the futility of World War II. You see, Adolf Hitler planned to unite Europe and establish an empire that would last for 1,000 years. He called it the 1,000-year Reich. And so he plunged the world into the largest war ever seen. It was not just the largest war, it was the most destructive war. It was the most widespread war. It was the most violent war. And it was the war that cost more lives than any other. You see, friends, World War II was the first truly global war. Every continent was involved. 61 countries participated, were involved in World War II. 61 countries with a combined population of 2 billion people, three quarters of the world's population then. 62 million people died in World War II as a result of World War II. Military personnel and civilians. 62 million. Just think of that. Three times the population of Australia in one war. And you know, friends, it was all unnecessary. It was all unnecessary because 2,500 years ago, a Hebrew prophet predicted the outcome of World War II. It was unnecessary. Unnecessary. What a waste of life. The writing was on the wall, we might say. The prophecy had been made. The prediction was there for everyone to see. There was no doubt about the outcome of the war. But you see, Adolf Hitler rejected God, he rejected the Bible, and he rejected Bible prophecy. In 1941, he made a significant speech to his people, the German people. And this is what he said. See, my people, We do not need anything from God. We do not ask anything from Him except that He may let us alone. We want to fight our own war with our own guns, without God. We want to gain victory without the help of God. Hitler rejected God, the Bible, and Bible prophecy. You see, friends, Adolf Hitler believed that he could conquer Europe with the strength of his armies and establish a world empire that would last for 1,000 years. But there was a German soldier by the name of Franz Hasel. He was conscripted into the army at the age of 40. Now, he was a pacifist, wouldn't carry a weapon. He was assigned to the elite pioneer company 699 and sent to the Russian front. Franz did believe the Bible. He did believe Bible prophecy. And he was familiar with the prophecy that we are going to investigate together today. And he, with that information, went to his commander and in fear of his death, he said to his commander, Germany cannot win this war. There is no way Adolf Hitler is going to unite Europe under one empire again. He said it's absolutely impossible. The writing is there for everyone to see. To his surprise, his commander read the information for himself in the Bible, read the prophecy, and accepted and believed it. And so as a result, he knew that there was no way they were going to be successful on the Russian front. Now remember, this battalion were on their way to the Eastern Front. He believed that they were going to suffer defeat on the Russian front, and so he took additional supplies in order to make a safe retreat. You know, ladies and gentlemen, on the Russian front, 2.7 million German soldiers died. More Russians. But 2.7 million German soldiers died on the Russian front. Another 2.6 German soldiers were taken prisoner. Hans Hasel was one of the few that survived. So what was this prophecy that he spoke to his commander about? This prophecy that predicted the doom and shattered the dream of Adolf Hitler. Well, the story begins 2,500 years ago in the golden city of ancient Babylon. This city was ruled, and this empire was ruled by a great warrior king by the name of Nebuchadnezzar. And Babylon truly was a golden city. It was one of the most magnificent cities our world has ever seen. It was filled with majestic towers and temples and palaces. In fact, ladies and gentlemen, it is believed that Nebuchadnezzar's palace is the greatest building ever constructed on planet Earth. It truly was a magnificent building. And this city was filled with gold. Its palaces, its temples, its monuments. In fact, historians tell us that this city was surrounded by a wall 100 kilometers long, between 80 and 100 meters high, and 8 meters wide. Behind that initial wall, 25 meters, was a second wall. This city also contained the second of the seven wonders of the ancient world, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. You see, Nebuchadnezzar married a princess from Media up in the mountains of the hinterland. And when she came to the plains of Babylonia, they were so dry and drab and flat that she was homesick for her mountains. So Nebuchadnezzar, being a good husband, he said, I will solve the problem. And he built the magnificent hanging gardens of Babylon. Magnificent city. The heart and the center of an empire that ruled the then known world. In the year 605 BC, Nebuchadnezzar, this great warrior king, set out on a mission of conquest. He gathered together the great armies of Babylonia. And he set out and he traveled along the route that we call today the Fertile Crescent. He traveled from Babylon across here to the Mediterranean, came down along the coast of the Mediterranean, defeated the great Egyptian army, and then he came back and he turned his attention to Jerusalem. He besieged the city, surrounded it, stopped people going in and out, stopped food and water going in and out. He defeated the city, he plundered the temple, took the gold vessels from outside the sacred temple of the Hebrew people, and he took with him a lot of Jewish captives. You see, friends, back in those days, it was the custom of the kings of nations and empires, when they defeated a people, they would take the cream of that nation, the most educated, the royal blood. They would take them as prisoners of war back to their capital city, and there they would train them and teach them to serve the new empire. Among those taken captive was a young Jewish nobleman of royal blood by the name of Daniel. Daniel and his three close friends were taken as prisoners of war back to Babylon. They hadn't been in Babylon very long when there was a huge uproar in the palace. And this is what happened. Nebuchadnezzar had gone to bed this particular night very concerned about the future of his empire. What was going to happen to him, his family, the royal family, and his people, his empire? He was worried about the future. And as he slept a troubled sleep that night, he had a dream. When he woke up the next morning, he couldn't remember what his dream was. But he was convinced that there were omens associated with this dream. It was a dream that had huge significance, and he had to know what the dream was and what it meant. We can probably understand how he felt. We often wake up in the morning remembering we had some sort of dream, but forgetting the details of the dream. But we certainly wouldn't go to the lengths that Nebuchadnezzar went to try to find out what our dream was. What did he do? Well, he called in the wise men of the empire. These were magicians, astrologers, wizards, who claimed to be in touch with the gods. And therefore, they could read people's mind. They could predict the future. They could tell a person's dream and interpret it. These were the royal wise men. They were an elite group, a privileged few. They lived in the palace. They lived in the lap of luxury. Why? Because they advised the king about the wisest decisions to make concerning the future. Why? Because they could read the future. They knew the future. And if you know the future, you never make a mistake regarding the decisions you have to make. So the king called them in. The wise men. These men who claimed to know the future, to be able to read people's minds, who claimed to be in touch with the gods. And he said to them, I've had a dream. A dream that troubles me and I want to know what it means. So he says, look, I've had a dream. It's troubled me. I want to know what it means. He said, now you people tell me that you're in touch with the gods. That through the dark practices of the occult, You magicians, wizards, and astrologers, you palm readers, you are able to read the future, to know what's in our minds. Therefore, I want you to tell me what I dreamt and what it means. A quite reasonable request for a king to make to people who claim to know all these things. Well, there was a little bit of concern amongst this fraternity of wise men, these magicians, these wizards, these astrologers. They'd never been asked to do this before. And so they came back to the king and they said, "O king, live forever. Now listen, king, you tell us the dream. You see, tell your servants the dream and then we'll interpret it for you. Easy." Can you see what they'd been doing? You see, you could tell me your dream and I could give you any interpretation I liked. But if you ask me first to tell you the dream, uh-oh. Now, these guys were in big strife. Because, you see, they weren't sure whether Nebuchadnezzar did actually remember his dream and was just putting them to the test, or whether he genuinely forgotten the dream. Very, very tricky situation to be in, because Nebuchadnezzar didn't mess about. But Nebuchadnezzar knew what was going on. The time was up for these guys, these magicians, these astrologers, these people that engaged in the dark practices of the occult, who claimed to be in touch with the gods, who claimed to be able to read people's minds and predict the future. And so the king was onto them and he said, "Tell me the dream. And if you can tell me the dream, then I will know that you can interpret it for me." They were in big, big trouble now. Big trouble. So they quickly had to, they had to level with the king. And they said, "King, come on. There isn't a man who alive who can tell others what they've dreamed? Be serious, please. This is an impossible thing that the king requires. You're being unreasonable. You know that it's really impossible for any of us to tell you what you dreamed." They went on and they said, "No one except the gods can tell you your dream." And then they really confessed. And they said, "Look, only the gods know that, and they're not here to help. In other words, we're not really in touch with the gods." How do you think Nebuchadnezzar felt? He'd been paying these guys big bucks. I'll tell you how he felt. He called his soldiers in and he said, "Kill every one of them and turn their houses into a dung heap. Every one of them. Kill them." Now, Daniel, the young prince from Jerusalem, who was a, shall we call him, an apprentice wise man, he was learning the ways of the wise men of Babylon. And so when Nebuchadnezzar just said offhand, "Kill them all," poor old Daniel and his friends were included. And the soldiers came to them to execute them. And Daniel said, "Hey, hold on a minute. What's this about? We don't know anything about this." And then he said, at this Daniel went to the king. So he said to Arioch, "Look, please take me to the king. Let me have a talk to the king. Please give us a chance. We didn't have a chance to answer the king's request. Give us a chance, please." At this, Daniel went to the king and he asked for time so that he might interpret the dream for him. He said, "King, give me some time. Give me some time." The king reluctantly agreed. What do you think Daniel did? he ran. He ran back to his home. He returned to his house and he explained the matter to his friends. He said, listen, guys, we are in trouble. If we don't go back to the king tomorrow with the information that he wants, we're at it. Us and all the wise men. And I want you to notice what he does. He urged them to plead for mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that he and his friends might not be executed with the rest of the wise men from Babylon. Daniel's in trouble, serious trouble. He needs help. And so he turns to the God of his fathers, the great Jehovah God of the Hebrew people. He prays. Let me tell you something, friends. The best way to get supernatural help with anything, any challenge we face today, is still through prayer. Still through prayer. Now, we all face challenges in life. They're all different challenges. Some of us might be facing challenges at work. Others might be facing health challenges. Some of us might be facing relationship challenges with family members, with our loved ones. Friends, whatever challenge you are facing, if you want supernatural help, then follow Daniel's example. Follow Daniel's example. See what happens. I'll tell you what worked for Daniel. Listen what happened. During the night, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision. And so as he lay there sleeping at night, after asking the great God of heaven, Jehovah God, to help him with this challenge that he faced, the mystery is revealed to him in a vision. He sees the dream. He's given the interpretation. So you bet next morning, as soon as he's up, guess where he goes? He runs straight to Arioch and he says, Arioch, don't execute the wise men of Babylon. Hold on. Wait a minute. Take me to the king and I will interpret his dream for him. Now, friends, picture the scene. Here's this young fellow from way off Jerusalem. Just a young chap. He's taken in to the palace of the most powerful person on the planet. A personal audience with the greatest king on the face of the earth. And imagine what this running through the king's mind. I've had my experienced wise men here, the astrologers, the magicians, the wizards, the palm readers. These guys who are so experienced in the dark practices of the occult. I've had them in here and they haven't been able to give me the answer I need. And here is this young Jewish boy and he thinks he's got it. So immediately he cuts to the chase and he says, listen, Daniel, can you tell me what my dream was and what it means? He doesn't want to mess about. He's a busy man. He's got an empire to rule. Can you? And then Daniel confesses. And he says, Nebuchadnezzar, listen, no wise man, no astrologer, magician, or wizard can tell the king such things. Ah, but there is a God in heaven. There's a God. Now, friends, just understand what's happening here. All these wise men, the magicians, the wizards, the astrologers, they claim to be in touch with their gods, didn't they? They claim to be able to get from their gods all the information that the king wanted, what his dream was, and what it meant. And here Daniel comes along and says, listen, don't worry about them. No magician, no astrologer, no, they'll never be able to tell you. Their gods, don't worry about them. But Nebuchadnezzar, there is a God in heaven, Jehovah God. And he is able, notice, There is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has told you in your dream what will happen when. He's told you. Remember, you went to bed that night and you were wondering what the future holds in store. Well, this God in heaven, the true God, the one and only God, he has told you what's going to happen in the future so that you will know. Nebuchadnezzar, amazed. Okay, get on with it then. You've told me, you can tell me the dream I had. You can tell me what I dreamt and what it meant. Come on, get on with it. And so Daniel then tells the king his dream. He says, King Nebuchadnezzar, as you were lying there, O king, your mind turned to things to what? You're worried about things in the future, things to come. You were worried about what's going to happen to you and your family and your empire. You were worried about the future. And the revealer of mysteries showed you what is going to happen. Now he gets to the detail. I can imagine Nebuchadnezzar a bit impatient. Well, get on with it. What did I dream? He said, well, you looked, O king, and there before you stood a giant statue, an enormous, dazzling statue. This statue is awesome in appearance. He said, a magnificent statue. That's what you saw in your dream. And then he gives the detail because, you see, he wants to leave Nebuchadnezzar in no doubt that he knows the dream. So he says, yeah, you saw this huge statue. Awesome, massive, dazzling in appearance. The head of the statue was made of pure gold. Its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze. So he begins to outline, here you saw this huge statue. It's made of different metals. The head's made of gold. The chest and arms are made of silver. The thighs are made of bronze. Then he continues and he says, and the legs, made of iron, solid iron. This guy's standing on strong legs. But hold on a minute. Its feet, partly of iron and partly of baked clay. So there it is, this massive statue. He's outlined all the details. And then he says that, and while you were watching, O king, a rock was cut out. But not by human hands. Amazing. This rock, it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay, and it absolutely smashed them. Smashed them to pieces. And then the iron, the clay, the bronze and the silver and the gold were broken to pieces and became like chaff on a threshing floor. And then he said, that's not all. The wind came and it swept them away. It left no trace of them. No trace of them whatsoever. But the rock, that rock that struck the image and destroyed it, that rock became a huge mountain and it filled the whole earth. Can you imagine Nebuchadnezzar? Absolutely right. That's exactly what I saw. You are absolutely right. I can imagine him sitting on the edge of his seat, looking at this young Jewish guy, Daniel, and saying, you've got it. You've got it. That's exactly what I saw as Daniel outlines to the king what he saw in his dream. But so what? He says, you saw this dream. The head was of gold, the chest and arms of silver, the thighs of bronze, the legs of iron, and the feet and toes were made of what? Partly iron and partly clay. And he said, as you were watching, this huge stone came. It was a stone that wasn't cut out. It's not man-made. It's got nothing to do with humanity. It's cut out. It comes. It smashes into the feet of the image, the feet of iron and clay, and it just obliterates them. And that great statue is just ground into dust. It's blown away by the wind. And the rock, it fills the whole earth. Now again, what does all this mean? What does it mean? Does it have any relevance to us today? Does it have any relevance for Nebuchadnezzar? Well, friends, in only 150 words, The dream outlines the main course of history from Babylon's day, 600 BC, to the climax of history. It starts with Babylon and then it stretches through generation after generation after generation, right down to the climax of human history. Nebuchadnezzar's saying, okay, Daniel, you're halfway there. You got the dream. Now, what does it mean? And so Daniel says, I've got it. The true God showed me. This is the dream, and now we will interpret it to the king. You are that head of gold. He said, Nebuchadnezzar, remember the image? Remember the image, the head was of gold? Well, that head, it symbolizes you. You, your kingdom, Babylon, is symbolized by that head of gold. The Babylonian Empire was the head of gold. And so, friends, as the prophecy unfolds, we find that each part of this metal image represents a world empire or nation that follows one after another. And Daniel says to Nebuchadnezzar, you're the head of gold. And how appropriate. Babylon was a golden empire. More gold than any other empire is seen. In fact, there was one statue, just one statue, historians tell us, in the heart of that city, right in the heart of the city. It was a statue to the god, their god, Marduk. It weighed 22 tons of solid gold. One statue. This was a golden city. It was a golden empire with a golden future. And Nebuchadnezzar was extremely proud of this city. In fact, friends, every brick that was used in its building, he put his own stamp on it. He wanted to be part of everything that happened. He was so proud of that city and what it stood for and what it represented. And he wanted it to last for how long? Forever. In fact, as archaeologists went to work there, they found a stone tablet. And on it was written by Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon, the city which is the delight of my eyes and which I have glorified, may it last for how long? Forever. But it wasn't. It wasn't to last forever. Because Daniel went on and said, hold on, Nebuchadnezzar. Hold on, king. I've got more to say. He said, after you, another kingdom will rise inferior to yours. And you know, Daniel lived to see that second empire take over. Remember the writing on the wall? The story of Belshazzar. The delinquent king, he ruled as a co-regent with his father Nabonidus, descendants of Nebuchadnezzar. See, remember, Babylon had walls 100 kilometers long, 80 to 100 meters high. Imagine that. 8 meters wide. In fact, it's so fantastic, people can hardly believe it today. Nobody could get inside those walls unless the inhabitants let you in. And so when the Medes and the Persians came and surrounded the city, Belshazzar and his friends stood up on the walls, waved to them, scoffed at them, and then went and had a feast. What do we need to worry about them for? Nobody will ever get through our walls. But you know, friends, 150 years beforehand, the prophet Isaiah had written in a scroll, who would overthrow Babylon, gave his name to the letter and outlined the method, the technique, the strategy he would use to overthrow Babylon. You see, nobody could get through the walls. Invincible. That's why Belshazzar was having a feast. They all got drunk. Nothing to worry about. But while they were in there getting drunk, the Medo-Persian army, the soldiers had gone upstream from the Euphrates River, which ran through that city. And they built canals. And at the precise moment that had been chosen, they broke the bank, the levee, and they let the water of the Euphrates run down the canal. The riverbed was dry. While Belshazzar and his nobles, his soldiers, his generals were in there drinking. And you know what they did? Belshazzar scoffed at the army and he said, "Listen, remember when we defeated Jerusalem? We went into the temple. We took all the golden vessels, the sacred temple vessels from Jerusalem. Go and get them. Who cares about the God of the Hebrews? Go and get them. We're going to eat and drink out of them tonight." While that was going on, the water was flowing down another canal. The soldiers of the Medo-Persian army marched through that along that riverbed. The great brass gates that were supposed to lock them out had been left carelessly unlocked. They pushed them open. They took the city without a fight. Belshazzar and his nobles, their lives all ended that night. And a new empire arose. The empire of Media Persia, the Medo-Persian Empire, defeated the Babylonians in the year 538 AD. And you know, ladies and gentlemen, if you ever go to London, take the time to go along to the British Museum. If you are interested in ancient artifacts and ancient history, you can visit no better place than the British Museum. And there in the British Museum, you will see for yourself the Cyrus cylinder. This cylinder was found in the ruins of ancient Babylon. And it tells in detail how Cyrus overthrew the Babylonian Empire. Exactly as the Bible had predicted. So the Medes and the Persians were the new ruling power, the new empire. They built an empire larger than any the world had ever seen. It stretched from the borders of India right across to North Africa. They ruled with one common language under one powerful king. But that empire wasn't to last forever either. Daniel went on and he said, "Next, a third kingdom, one of bronze, will rule over the whole earth." Every schoolboy knows that it was the armies of Alexander the Great, the Grecian army, that destroyed the Persian army under Darius. Under their charismatic young king, Alexander the Great, they stormed to world prominence. Alexander the Great was probably the greatest military genius the world has ever seen. You know, friends, at 20 he had conquered the city-states of Greece, united them all in one army. At 24 he was Pharaoh of Egypt. At 25 he was Lord of Persia. He was never, ever defeated in a military battle. A brilliant military tactician. He ruled an empire larger than anything the world had ever seen. He was Lord and King of everything he could see at the age of 25. I want to tell you something interesting. How many of you were here for the first program in this series 2 weeks ago? Okay, quite a few of you. Remember we spoke about the Bible prediction of Tyre and how Tyre was destroyed and all the rubble and the dust was collected by Alexander and his soldiers? Remember he came to defeat Tyre. The citizens were very smart. They got in their boats. They were seafarers, the Phoenicians. They got in their boats and they sailed over to a little island about a kilometer away and they just scoffed at Alexander and his army. It made Alexander mad because he didn't have a navy. So you know what he did? Remember? He grabbed up all the rubble. He said, "Soldiers, grab it all up. We're going to get them. Build a causeway. We're going to get them, come what may." They put all the rubble in, the towers, the bricks, the broken timber and so forth. They still couldn't make it. So he said, "Go back and even scrape up the dust. We're going to get them." He defeated Tyre, remember? After he defeated Tyre, he turned his attention to Jerusalem. Was next on the list. And as his armies marched towards Jerusalem, the inhabitants of Jerusalem feared for their lives. There was nothing they could do. They had no army that could withstand stand Alexander the Great? And so after discussion, the priest, the high priest, went out to meet Alexander before he got to the city. He said, I've got something to show you. Oh yeah? Make it quick, mate. You know what he showed him? The scroll of Daniel. And he said, Alexander, you are on your way to fight the Persian king Darius. He's got an army of 1 million men waiting for you. But you are going to be victorious. And you know how I know you're going to be victorious? I'm going to show you the prophecies of the ancient prophet Daniel. And friend, the prophecy that we are looking at, he showed Alexander and he showed him the other prophecies in the scroll of Daniel that relate to Alexander the Great. How he was going to be successful. How he was going to defeat the Persians. How he would establish a world empire. Alexander was so amazed. He was flabbergasted. His breath was taken away. He recognized the authenticity of Daniel the prophet and the Hebrew scriptures. And he said, I leave you, Jerusalem and the Jewish people, in peace to practice your religion as your conscience dictates. Jerusalem was spared because Alexander the Great saw his own destiny outlined in the prophecies of Daniel the prophet. He sat there as the Jewish priests showed him these great prophecies. And so he ruled a massive empire. But that empire wasn't to last forever. Notice, finally there will be a fourth kingdom, Daniel said to Nebuchadnezzar. There'll be a fourth kingdom strong as iron. And iron breaks and smashes everything. And as iron breaks things to pieces, so it will crush and break all others. This is the fourth empire. Friends, we know that it was the Romans who overthrew the Greeks. The Romans ruled the world, the then known world, for half a millennium. Over 500 years. And they established the greatest world empire that history has ever seen. It stretched from the Atlantic right through to the Euphrates. The great Caesars ruled supreme. Their Caesars are still household names for us. Julius Caesar, Augustus, Tiberius, Nero, Vespasian, and we could go on and on. And the treasure and the loot of the empire flowed into their capital city, Rome. Rome was the center of their world empire. And it was a city befitting the capital of a world empire. And right at the heart of this city was the golden milestone. Because remember, friends, all roads in that empire led where? Led to Rome and to the golden milestone. You can still see the base there of the golden milestone in the Roman Forum today. Mighty Rome. The center of their entertainment was the Colosseum. 50,000 people could fit into the Colosseum. And they became a bloodthirsty lot. They came to watch the gladiators fight. Gladiators who would fight to the death. They would fight other gladiators. They would fight wild animals. In fact, friends, their bloodlust was such that there were days when 5,000 wild animals were killed in the Colosseum. They had a hunger for blood. And it appeared that this mighty empire, the Empire of Rome, that stretched from the Atlantic Ocean right through to the Euphrates, was invincible. It would last forever. For more than 500 years, Rome ruled the world. And it appeared that it was invincible. Its standards were seen right across that range from the Atlantic Ocean right through the Euphrates River and beyond. But Daniel had more to say. He said, Nebuchadnezzar, just as you saw that the feet and toes were partly of baked clay and partly of iron, So this will be what? A divided kingdom. He said, Nebuchadnezzar, it's going to end. And those feet that are made partly of iron and partly of clay, this represents the breakup of the Roman Empire into smaller kingdoms and nations. And so, friends, instead of another world empire, Rome would be divided into numerous kingdoms, nations, symbolized by the 10 toes. Unbelievable, inconceivable, but true. That's exactly what happened. You see, friends, the Roman Empire crumbled in two ways. Firstly, from within, and secondly, from without. Firstly, from within, you see, as the wealth and the loot of the empire began to flow into that city, it changed the lifestyle of the Romans. From living Spartan, true Roman lifestyle, they changed to lives of luxury and extravagance. And so the empire, the city, the nation began to rot from within. From within came corruption of politicians, crime and violence on the streets, sexual immorality became rampant. Look, just read a history of Rome, find that out. Times changed from the times of Caesar Augustus and Julius Caesar. When you get down to Nero and the other emperors, man, the debauchery and the corruption and the filth. The empire was corrupted from within. Rotten to the core. In the meantime, there were threats from without. As the empire weakened from within, Rome faced dreadful attack from without because the barbarian tribes from the north began to attack them. In fact, by 476 AD, these barbarian tribes had conquered Rome. The interesting thing is this, that 10 of those tribes eventually became the nations of modern Europe. You look at the map of old Europe, those tribes, see them there? They became the founding nations of modern Europe. The Alemanni became the Germans, the Burgundians became the Swiss, the Franks, the French, the Lombards, the Italians, the Anglo-Saxons, who? England. The Servi became the Portuguese, the Visigoths, the Spanish. And then the Heruli, the Ostrogoths, and the Vandals. Do you know that Daniel even predicted in another prophecy what would happen to the final three? That they wouldn't survive? Amazing insight into the future. The detail is uncanny. It's uncanny. And he said, as the toes were partly iron and partly clay, listen as he gives more detail. It's amazing. So this kingdom will be partly strong and partly brittle. You know, friends, you can look at the nations of modern Europe. You'll see some that are strong politically, powerful economically, that have a strong military base. You'll see others that, man, they're nothing. What did Daniel say? Some of them will be powerful, they'll be strong. Others will be weak. And then he said, as you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, listen to this very carefully. Look at the detail here. They will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere one to another. You know, friends, the Bible predicted that the nations of modern Europe would attempt to unite their nations into one empire again, and they will use three main forms to bring this about. Three methods that they would use to bring the empire together again. Firstly, they would do it politically by war. Secondly, they would do it economically by currency and trade. And thirdly, socially by intermarriage. They would mingle with the seed of men. So the Bible predicts that the nations of modern Europe would mix together and try to unite again, try to bring about a major empire again. But the Bible predicted that no matter how hard they try, they would never ever be fully united again. Friends, the Bible predicted that there would always be separate nations in Europe, and they would never become a single entity in the same way as the United States, for example, is a single nation. Remember how they would try to do it? Politically by war, economically by currency and trade, and socially by marriage. I'm going to tell you something very interesting. Napoleon Bonaparte wanted to sit on the throne of a united Europe as a Caesar. He wanted to reform the Roman Empire. So what did he do? He divorced Josephine and he married Maria Luisa of Austria to unite the powerful Napoleonic line with the Habsburg dynasty in an attempt to unite Europe by marriage. Do you know that at the start of World War I, that's not all that long ago, less than 100 years, all the major powers of Europe, the heads of the royal families, were all related to each other. All related to each other without exception. What did the prophecy say? They would unite with the seed. Through intermarriage, they were going to try to unite Europe again. Napoleon said, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it through marriage. I'm going to unite the big families together. And I'm going to do it through force. He said, there will be a European system, a European code of law, a European court of appeals. There will be one Europe. What did the Bible say? They shall not adhere. Four simple, clear, crisp words. And attempts have been made to overturn this prophecy and to unite Europe again under one empire, under one leader. And you know, ladies and gentlemen, the greatest military minds, the most powerful nations on earth have tried to do just that. Charlemagne tried. He failed. Charles V tried. He failed. Louis XIV tried. He failed. Napoleon Bonaparte. Nobody came closer than Napoleon. He was on the verge of uniting Europe. You know what stopped him dead in his tracks? The Russian winter. The Russian winter. And the doggedness of those Russian fighters. He lost his army in the snows of Russia. Napoleon, he was going to unite Europe come what may. The Bible said, they shall not adhere. And then came Kaiser Wilhelm II. He was going to unite Europe. And as he was preparing his war machine to launch a war to bring all of Europe under his control, somebody came up to him and said, excuse me, Kaiser, are you aware that Daniel the prophet has said that Europe is never going to be reunited? He said, listen, Daniel's prophecy, it just doesn't fit in with my plans. I can't accept what he says. Where Charlemagne and others have failed, I will succeed. I will unite Europe again. I will form one Europe, one empire. Now, friends, you can go to the city of Metz. Remember Charles Havlet, the last Allied soldier to be killed in World War II? He's buried just a few kilometers away from Metz, from this cathedral. Before the start of World War I, this magnificent cathedral had to have its roof replaced. It needed a lead roof. The citizens couldn't afford it because all the money was going into the war machine. Kaiser was building up his military to overthrow the world. Kaiser heard that they needed a roof. Now, around this church, there are statues of all the apostles and the great prophets. Kaiser heard that this church needed a new roof, so he said, look, he contacted the citizens and he said, I'll do it for you. You can imagine, they were just overwhelmed with his graciousness, his goodness. Thank you so much. He said, but there's one condition. Oh, yes, what's that? Simply this. I want you to take the head off one of the statues in the front of your church, and I want you to put my head there in its place. Okay, which statue? He said, well, we've got all these statues. Which one? He said, right there on the front of the church, that is the statue of Daniel. See him holding the scroll? He has made a prediction that I don't agree with. It doesn't fit my plan. Take his head off, put mine in its place, because I'm going to prove him wrong. So they got their new roof, and Daniel got a new head. The head of Kaiser. You can see the statue. It's still there today. You can see him holding his scroll there. Daniel pointing to his prediction, his prophecy. So Kaiser came along and said, offer this head, put mine there in its place. Well, friends, we know the outcome of Kaiser's dream and activities. Do you know that over 16 million people died as a result of his ambition to unite Europe? 16 million. We were over filming recently an Anzac program, and just to come face to face with those trenches and that warfare and the gas, and you can't believe that men were subjected to a death like that. Why? Because this guy wanted to sit on the throne of a united Europe. Over 16 million died. Well, after the war had ended and Hitler came to power, he came to Metz and he said, get Kaiser's head off there quickly. Kaiser had it wrong. Daniel's right. Kaiser was unable to conquer Europe. But he said, listen, where Kaiser failed, I'm going to do it. And with an army of 5 million, Hitler promised to do what Kaiser couldn't. He promised to unite Europe and build an empire that would last for how long? 1,000 years. His empire was going to last double the period of the Roman Empire. We all know the result. 62 million people dead because of his desire, his arrogance in wanting to unite Europe under his command. Yes, friends, they've all tried. Charlemagne, Charles V, Louis XIV, Napoleon, Wilhelm II, Adolf Hitler. What did the Bible say? As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere one to another. So, what does all this mean to you and me? Living here 2011, an ancient prediction, an ancient dream made 2,500 years ago. What's it got to do with us? Simply this, friends, it tells us where we are living in the stream of time. This prediction has been fulfilled in every final detail. And it tells us where we are living. We're not living in the time of Babylon. We're not living in the chest and arms of silver, Medo-Persia. We're not living in the time of Greece, the thighs of brass. We're not living during the empire of Rome, the legs of iron. We're living in the times of modern Europe. Listen to what Daniel said. In the days of those kings. Which kings? The nations of modern Europe. The God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed. nor will it be left to another people. And it goes on to say, it will crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end, but it itself will endure for how long? Forever. Remember Franz Joseph? Franz Hasel? Friends, he with a simple faith believed the Bible, accepted Jesus as his Savior. He believed the prophecies of the Bible. He believed that there is a God in heaven who is in control of events on this planet. He believed that this God is going to come back, that Jesus is going to return, and he's going to set up a kingdom that will last forever. He believed, and he found peace. He found safety. He found security. You see, friends, where are we living? We are living in the toenails of the great image. In the toenails of the image. The next great event is the coming of Jesus Christ. Jesus is coming to establish his kingdom. And how long is it going to last? Forever. And what does that mean to you and me? Let me tell you what Jesus said. Fear not, little flock, for it's your Father's good pleasure to give you what? To give you the kingdom. Oh, my friends, Jesus Christ is coming soon. I can say that unashamedly and with absolute certainty, because the prediction, the prophecy is true. It's been fulfilled in every detail. Jesus is coming soon. And he wants every one of us to be ready to meet him. He wants us to be citizens in his kingdom. Fear not, little flock, he says, for it is the Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. It's my prayer that when Jesus comes as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, that each one of us here will be found ready and waiting to meet him. Let's close our meeting with a word of prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for your love and your goodness to us in giving us the Bible, that outlines to us these enormous prophecies and shows us where we are living in the stream of time. Lord, we can see that as this prophecy has unfolded, as it's been fulfilled in every detail, that we are very close to the coming of Jesus. Lord, we want to put our faith and our trust in Jesus and the Bible and its prophecies just as Franz Hasel did. We want to be ready to meet Jesus when he comes. Grant each one of us here that privilege. I ask in Jesus' name and for his sake. Amen.